Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Sustainable Investing Perspectives podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For this month, we are happy to welcome to the podcast series from our partners at Federated Hermes, Will Pomeroy. Will is head of impact engagement equities with the firm, joining me here in our 1285 podcast studio in New York. Glad to welcome back Amantya Muhadini from the UBS Chief Investment Office, a sustainable and impact investor. Strategist for the Americas. So as you, our listeners, know, on this podcast series, we like to link our conversation to the Sustainable Investing Perspectives publication series from the UBS Chief Investment Office. The latest report is now available for you up on ubs.com/CIO. Within this month's edition, it does cover three topics focused on the early stage of investment in female-led companies, EU sustainability regulation, and China's power market. So for today, though, in light of International Women's Day, which recently took place on March 8th, Amantya and Will are joining us to discuss news headlines on U.S. companies pulling back workforce diversity and inclusion policy. So with that, Amantya, Will, it's great to be with you both, and thank you for dropping by the podcast to spend some time with our listeners.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Amantya, to start, can you provide our listeners with a bit of context on what you have seen around this and why it matters?
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Dan. This question of workforce diversity and inclusion policies has very much been a top-of-mind conversation for investors, and we're seeing it covered in the news a lot. While in our report, we focus on something very specific this month. We are looking at venture capital investment data for companies that are led by women. We're also taking a step back here in this conversation, and I'm so grateful that we have Will to help us with it. To look at kind of some of the implications on the corporate side of what we've discussed as kind of more of the anti-DEI pushback. And now what I'll say here is that while there's been so much back and forth around this topic and the three-letter acronym, the way that we framed our research on the topic and we've discussed in this podcast over years now is around the concept of investing in those companies that are really excelling at identifying the right employee for the right job and especially also keeping that employee once they've recruited them into the job. And that's how we think of workforce measurement, workforce diversity, and inclusion policies as a really a tool to achieve that objective. So that's kind of the context here. Now, as I said, I'm very happy, Will, that you're joining us in the conversation because we'd really appreciate to hear from you very specifically what your engagement discussions look like with companies around these topics. But even before you go there, maybe you also can take a step back and start us off with kind of what are these workforce issues that are financially relevant to companies' operations? Like, why are we even talking about this?
Absolutely. Thanks, Amantya. Great to be with you both. So, yeah, let's maybe start by taking that step back. As well, the workforce is a critical asset for nearly all companies. And indeed, if Fortune has an asset, it's that rare thing of being, if nurtured, an appreciating asset. And the old adage that culture eats strategy for breakfast is clearly a truism. You know, I'm sure you, I, and the folks listening to this conversation will have all worked at various companies that know this to be true. Indeed, you know, many of us spend more time with our colleagues than with our family and friends, and we know how important that healthy corporate culture is. And as long-term investors, therefore, we've always sought to incorporate it into our investment appraisal process and our engagement conversations. Indeed, as sustainability investors, we also believe that companies have a responsibility to support and safeguard their employees' financial, physical, and mental well-being. But fundamentally, however, we believe that fulfilling those responsibilities towards their employees promotes that healthy and, dare I say it, equitable and inclusive culture that I was alluding to before. Because it's that culture that ultimately drives customer satisfaction, drives innovation, and drives productivity. So when we incorporate those indicators into our investment process and our conversations, we've always considered it to be material, but we probably arguably consider it to be more material and more important today than ever, not least because of the physical backdrop, which we'll come on to in a moment, but also just that, you know, companies increasingly resemble knowledge networks. They have increasing reliance on intellectual capital to drive the growth going forward. And we know there are real skills shortages that are growing, and the communities in which companies are situated are getting more diverse. So, irrespective of that backdrop, good companies continue to know that they need to recruit from a broad population and they know they need to retain and develop the skills and talent they have available to them, because that's the only way they're going to be able to continue to compete in the next few years, as that intellectual capital and the importance of the workforce grows in importance, building on what was already a pretty important base to begin with.
Yeah, no, that makes sense, Will. And one more example that I'd add there, just to be in some ways more concrete, you're talking about companies as knowledge networks. And I think that's true in parts of the economy. There's lots of other growing areas of the economy that really we're looking for very specific skills. I mean, I think of the energy transition and the need to recruit people in all parts of that value chain, from HVAC engineers to electricians and so forth. And what's interesting is we have been looking to some data from the International Labor Organization, the ILO, and we found there that in a lot of these skill sets require education and training that is very on-the-job kind of education, professional training, vocational schooling, and so forth. And to bring this to this question of gender and inclusion and culture, as you're saying, women tend to be really underrepresented in these vocational training programs, which means that if you are a company and you need to hire for electricians and HVAC and engineers, and you cannot find enough people with the right skills, you need to look broadly. Now, the ILO says women are underrepresented because a lot of how those trainings are offered, a lot of the environment, i.e. culture, use that word, in those programs is not conducive to women around the world. And so that is, in my mind, a very concrete example why, from a corporate perspective, it really matters here to kind of focus on these areas.
So, Will, I'm curious, just giving your experience to bring this to life a bit more for our listeners, what are your conversations with companies now amid the headlines?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I guess, fundamentally, our conversations are continuing. And I reflect back over the last sort of 6-7 years of conversations with companies, human capital and workforce matters have always been the topic area that we've engaged with companies on the most. And now, given some of the backdrop to the conversation we're having today, and that's now even more so. We've long been very engaged shareholders, and human capital has always been one of those intangible topics that's quite hard to get a grasp on from a company's 10K and other financial filings. And therefore, the engagement has always been critical to get a sense of what the corporate culture actually looks like or is in practice. So it's getting data, but it also allows us, obviously, to influence some of those corporate practices too. And the companies have long stated that employees are their most valuable asset, and we all know post-2020, most of corporate America similarly expressed commitments to address racial and gender inequities too. But in some cases, there was likely some virtue signalling or indeed well-meaning initiatives that were clumsily packaged or communicated. And we've now seen, obviously, over the last 6 to 9 months, a bit of a step back in both the disclosure and communication efforts, but obviously certainly some of those headline commitments too. However, in our view, DEI goals are not, or at least should not be, about quotas in the corporate world. But the end goals are about meeting labour requirements, enhancing employee engagement and customer sentiment, broadening that recruitment net, and indeed the reach of their sales effort, because they're business initiatives and business goals at the end, and the DEI piece is the means to an end. I think Amantra very neatly highlights a bit the challenge in some of the faster growth sectors of the economy today that quite commonly exhibit the bigger gender diversity gaps within the wider economy. And that really does illustrate the need for some of those companies in those sectors to think more imaginatively about where it is they're recruiting from. Otherwise, the skills gaps that they have today are just going to keep growing year on year. So there's kind of three broad buckets of topics that we are engaging with companies on today within this agenda. The first is the board and management oversight of the whole piece. And what is the graph from the top on the workforce composition? What are the skills gaps? What are the sentiment levels? What are the turnover rates? Do boards have the data? And have they audited whether their policies are being enacted in practice? The second piece is that employee engagement piece. So, what is the tone from the top? What are the channels of communication, and how adequate is that communication, both top-down but also bottom-up too? And then finally, it's the development piece, which we've just circled on back to a couple of times. Both how meritocratic is the retention, development, and promotion policies? Is the company realising the true value of their human capital? What are the skills gaps? They're presumably likely growing, so does broadening the recruitment net play a role in resolving that gap? And does more equitable talent development practices have a role again in addressing that challenge that the companies are grappling with today, have been regularly calling out on earnings calls over the last few years, and there's a challenge that's certainly going to be growing in the years to come. So despite some of the political noise, it's a hugely salient and hugely material topic for us as shareholders to continue to engage with companies on, and we'll certainly continue to do so.
Yeah, that's helpful, Will. And really what you're doing here is, in giving these examples, is showing the complexity of analysis that investors need to be taking. And this has always been true. In some ways, the difference is only that where a few years ago, the question I would hear most from UBS clients was on both matters of social inclusion and climate. How do I know that these companies are not greenwashing when they come out with a press release on something, some target that they're setting? In some ways, the question that I'm being asked now by those same sets of investors is, I'm seeing a different set of press releases from the same companies. Am I at risk that of investing in names that now are pulling back their long-term focus? So how would you answer that? How do you go about identifying really those companies that are truly committed versus the ones that are pulling back from these financial and material elements?
Yeah, I think that's certainly the key question at the moment, Mancha. You know, we've long worried about greenwashing, and then there's the concern about greenwashing. I think we're certainly now seeing, you know, a very significant rise of DEI flashing and everything associated with that. Now, I've had many conversations with corporate directors since certainly last summer on precisely this topic of how can companies continue to evidence their commitment to that business goal of creating and sustaining a diverse, inclusive, engaged and motivated workforce while stepping away from some of the language and initiatives that are currently very triggering to stakeholders out there. Most companies have diluted the language that they've previously included within their 10Ks, but not all have. Many have kind of stayed the course with the language they were using previously. Where anti-DEI shareholder proposals have been tabled just this year so far, you know, they're typically receiving 1% to 2% support. So shareholders are continuing to give the signal of their own belief in the need to continue with the substantive elements of those workforce and talent development programs that were in place before. But where disclosures are stepping back, you know, we are engaging with management teams and board members to understand what, if anything, is changing substantively. And in most cases, little has, frankly. You know, some philanthropic spend has been cut back. Some targets have been dropped. But in disclosures, we can still observe the diversity of the workforce itself at multiple levels of the organization. We can still observe the organizations with whom the company's working with to hire from broad populations. We can still observe employee sentiment levels and turnover rates, and we can still track productivity. Therefore, I guess being more optimistic and a kind of glass half full view of some of the activities at the moment and the headlines, there is a hope that possibly the conversation is moving on to a more substantive one than maybe it was previously. It's now more financially framed. There's a clear understanding that diversity is the means to an end, and it's a very important means to a financial end, as well, frankly, as a social end too. But it's now a much more of a financial conversation focused around some of the outcomes of the initiatives, as opposed to maybe in the past, in some cases, being a conversation around targets and very much kind of the input, which obviously therefore slightly, in some quarters, kind of missed the wood to the trees of what the end goal always was. And I think maybe we can get to a better outcome once some of the noise settles down.
So, Amanti, as we begin to close out our conversation today, to make this a bit actionable for our listeners, our clients, what do you recommend for investors interested in these topics in this shifting landscape?
Yeah, thanks. And look, I mean, in some ways, the takeaway for me this whole time and kind of listening to Will's comments is that the action is wait and see and really pay attention and really don't look at the headlines. Don't even focus on things like scoring or kind of top line metrics. And I like what Will said, you know, we're moving from inputs to outputs in conversation. So really focusing on those strategies that are truly intentional in identifying how sustainability ties to financial materiality for companies and are truly doing that systematically. I think that probably is the best set of questions for investors and our clients to think about and kind of wait up before taking any immediate actions.
Well, just given how fluid, quickly moving these headlines are, very helpful today to have some perspective around this. And I do appreciate the guidance as to how investors should respond. So, Amantia, Will, thank you very much for your time today and for joining us on the SI Perspectives podcast series.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.